The conference is now being recorded.
Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to our webinar, Navigating Legal Issues in India, IP-Centric Transaction. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Ms. Lynette. Thank you and over to you, ma'am.
Hi, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us at the SAI Associates webinar. My name is Lynette Hyrapetian. I'm joining you from our Silicon Valley office based in Palo Alto, California. We have yet another informative webinar planned. Today's topic is Navigating Legal Issues in India, IP-Centric Transaction. A little bit about our firm. Nishith Desai Associates is a strategy-driven, research-focused Indian law firm providing legal, regulatory, and tax counsel to clients which are or aspire to be global. Our core competencies are intellectual property, regulatory and public policy, international tax, corporate and securities, dispute resolution. I would like to introduce you to today's speaker. Based out of our New York office, Vaibhav Parikh. He leads the technology, M&A, private equity, blockchain, and virtual currencies practices. Based in our Mumbai office, Gauri Gokhale. She leads the IP, technology, media, and entertainment law practices. Also based out of our Mumbai office, Arushi Jain. She co-leads the IP, technology, media, and entertainment law practice and commercial law practices. I will hand over to our panelists now, Gauri.
Thanks, Lynette. Good morning, those who are joining from the U.S., and good evening to those who are joining from our own jurisdiction. Today we are going to discuss very, very interesting topic which is very close to my heart. Have been practicing IP law for probably last more than 23 years, and I have had a chance to look both on the IP litigation and IP transactional side, which has been a very, very interesting journey personally. And during this journey, we have seen large number of issues that are arising, in corporate transactions, joint ventures, in IP specific, acquisitions, etc. And one thing which, strikingly comes out every time is that not everybody looks at intellectual property with the same lens. Some sometimes completely miss the major issue. For example, in one of the transactions that we encountered, on the litigation side, we realized the transaction documents were all very well drafted, all the IP transfers were very well drafted. But when we sort of went into the complete history, we realized that the company that was transferring the IP did not in the first place hold that IP, right? And therefore, the entire litigation was coming out. So, when we see some of these experiences, the other experience I distinctly remember right there at the beginning of my practice, where one of the key investors was looking at a software company for investment, and the software company had not really, registered their trademark. Honestly, as most of you will realize, that is not such a big issue. One could still go ahead and register a trademark if you have a user. But the way the key investor looked at this particular, due diligence piece of information to say that a company which has not even registered the trademark, how IP aware is that company, right? So their perspective of looking at, this entire thing was different, and they actually decided only on this. Of course, there may be other grounds, but this was one of the key grounds where they decided not to go ahead with the transaction. What we try to do today, with these experiences that we have seen, these kind of issues, IP transactions across different jurisdictions may have similar issues. However, what we try to do today is basically demonstrate what are some of the key issues that you will notice in the Indian context. For example, the sheer lack of IP awareness. especially in the startup or, you know, mid-segment companies, what issues do we face because of that? What are the special laws under in the Indian context because of which we have seen some of the issues arising? So Arushi, my colleague, will first deal with the due diligence aspects, some of the key considerations in the IT context. Thereafter, I will come in and talk about more on the IT structuring. What are the, basically more on the case study, because I believe with the case studies, the participants will appreciate various aspects of the deal making. And then Vaibhav will, of course, come in with his experience on negotiating the contract with, what are the key reps and warranties issues, indemnities, insurance issues that come up. And briefly also touch upon the governing law and dispute resolution, which sometimes is the last negotiated clause, but one of the most important clauses, in the transactional documents. We will also briefly touch upon the competition law issues. We all can recognize that that is a subject by itself. So we will at least highlight the issues that have to be taken into account, and maybe some other time we will deal with the actual, issues that you may come across. So I will stop here and hand it over to my colleague Arushi to walk you through some of the very interesting issues in the due diligence process that we have seen in the Indian context. Over to you, Arushi.
Thank you so much, Gauri, and welcome everyone. For those in India, thank you for taking this call late in the night, and those in the US, a very good morning to you, and hope we make your day bright with this conversation today. As you know, we have a lot to cover in this 50-minute conversation. We leave 10 minutes of Q&A at the end of it, so I'll jump straight into the conversation. Trademarks, copyrights, patents, and to a little extent, trade secrets is what I will quickly brush upon, but you will appreciate we cannot really get into the details of each issue that we face in a due diligence, so I'll touch upon some key issues. Starting with trademarks, classic example, company A and company B decide that A wants to sell the brand to B, B and A do a handshake deal, commercials are frozen, price is frozen. And then we go into the due diligence and we realize that company A actually is not the registered owner of the brand. The trademark registry records show that it is actually a group entity, or sometimes maybe the director or a proprietor of that entity which has registered the brand. And therefore now there are difficulties with respect to transfer from that company A to company B because the back-to-back rights are not clear. Is this an addressable issue? The answer to that is yes. One can always address it with documentation, with clearing the title. But some peculiar nuances kind of arise here, especially in a cross-border situation. If the trademark is actually, supposed to be owned cross-border, for example, it's to be owned or it is actually owned and registered by a parent entity, which is not an entity based in India, and there is a consideration that needs to be, brought in for the purpose of this assignment, and the parties are related parties, then certain nuances from a tax law perspective would come in. The consideration could not be, in that case, determined by commercials only. If the trademark is heavily exploited, is well known, then there could be a higher value attached for the purpose of this intercompany assignment itself. That could result into some commercial roadblocks. The second issue that could possibly arise is that if the proprietor or the individual who is owning the brand or the company, which is actually the registered owner of the brand, may have just registered and forgotten about it, and then a group company is actually exploiting the brand. There may not be any license agreement in place at that point in time. So the question becomes a question of fact that how is that company which is proposing to sell the brand getting the rights, the back-to-back rights to actually sell that brand? How has it been even using that brand in the first place? Is there a license in place? If there is a license in place, then what are the controls? Because trademark law requires that the licensor exercises control over the trademark with respect to the licensee's use of the brand. If that's not done, there could be a question where, the trademark license could be considered a naked license. And if that happens, there also is a bigger question mark that has the licensor actually abandoned the rights to the trademark in the first place. So these are some typical, issues that arise, and in a cross-border scenario, one pays specific attention to it. Then the next point that I want to deal with is a question of associated trademarks. Associated trademarks, like we all know, are trademarks which are basically, identical or very similar. They are filed in the same class of the trademark for the purpose of trademark registration in the name of the same proprietor. When that happens, the registry basically recognizes that we cannot create confusion between the ownership, so we will associate these marks. What happens when the marks are associated? Number one, there is usually a noting which is made in your registration certificate with respect to the marks being associated. That's also available online when you look at the records. And in India now, you can look at the trademark records online. But sometimes, peculiarly, the registrar may record the noting in one mark and may not record the noting in another mark, in which case you may not exactly know which marks are associated. Associated marks are also treated as a cluster, which basically means that if there is an assignment of the mark, you have to assign them together, otherwise the assignment won't stand valid. The option to this is you can disassociate the marks, which is a process in itself, but then that's a commercial call. If you're not disassociating the marks and you're selling the brands as a cluster, then what is the value that you want to assign to the mark which is tagging along? So that's some commercial points one needs to think about. Another aspect with respect to trademarks is with respect to non-use. Many times, brands are registered, they are allowed to continue on the register, but they are not actually exploited. It usually happens in large conglomerates where they can keep on, you know, creating a library of sorts of brands. In such cases, a third party could always, you know, object to continuing of the brand on the register. And if that happens, the brand stands at the risk of being removed from the register. In such cases, what is the value of the brand is one is what needs to be determined. And like Gauri was saying, sometimes in our jurisdiction, it happens that maybe because of sheer lack of negligence, the trademark is allowed to lapse. It's not renewed. Procedural aspects are continuing. Trademark is not registered, but certain filings have been missed. If that happens, the trademark is not registered and you lose that statutory right. There may be a common law right to attach to your usage of the mark, but at least as far as the registration is concerned, that's not obtained. One can always go and file for registration, but that takes a little bit of a time lag and optical issues as to maintenance of the rights in the brand. I'll move on to copyrights now. Now, interestingly, under Indian law, there are some very specific nuances. If the term of a copyright assignment or license in contracts which are governed through Indian law and Indian created copyrights are not assigned, the term is by default considered to be 5 years. If territory is not recognized in a contract, it's by default considered to be India territory. We also have a very specific provision under the law which basically says that if there is an assigner or a licensor who is given the rights to an assignee or licensee as the case may be, and that recipient of the rights has not actually exercised the rights which are granted within a period of 1 year, the rights revert back to the grantor unless parties contract out of this provision. Now, at times you will see that, you know, sometimes copyright acquisitions are done maybe to create libraries, maybe, you know, to build up the portfolios, but the exploitation may not happen immediately. In such circumstances, it is essential to make sure that these provisions are looked into. Also becomes a diligence point. The other aspect from a copyright perspective that I would like to talk about is that Indian copyright law looks at transfer of rights slightly differently when it comes to an employer-employee situation and when it comes to an independent consultant or contractor situation. Under our law, if the work has been created, copyright work has been created by an employee, then the first owner becomes the employer. That's only for the purpose of copyrights, not for trademarks, not for patents, copyrights only. But at least there's an enabling provision there, though we still prefer to have specific assignment clauses in the contract. That's not the case when it comes to consultants and independent contractors. For them, you have to make sure that assignments are properly documented. Now, suppose company, a foreign enterprise wants to acquire certain software which is protected as copyright in India, from a company and, you know, is taking standard representations and warranties with respect to the IP ownership and the back-to-back rights. Now, once you do the diligence and if these clauses are missing, there could be, you know, some confusion with respect to who owns the rights, whether the company which is assigning these rights actually has the proper rights and title to assign or not. These are issues which one can address by way of documentation, but that means the added effort of trying to find who creates
created the work, how the title was cleared, since when was the assignment effective. So there are multiple, you know, issues that might come out to it. I'll move on to patents now. Now, patents, like trademarks, are territorial rights. There's nothing called, there's no concept of a worldwide patent. And that's a very important point that one needs to keep in mind, because patents don't come, you know, patent registration, patent maintenance are also very, very expensive. Look at a classic scenario where, you know, there is a US-based enterprise or a Europe-based enterprise. It has branches and it has subsidiaries across the world. And the principal asset that it wants to sell off is basically its IP, which is in the nature of a patent today. Now, for some reason, it is determined that India is a very important jurisdiction for the purpose of exploitation of that patent. Having said that, during diligence, it is found that there is no patent which was registered for that particular technology in India. And the time period within which one could actually file for a patent application in India has also lapsed. This becomes a huge commercial deadlock also, in addition to being a red flag from a legal perspective. One can always address these issues by working out separate arrangements such as technology licenses, etc., which lawyers are good at crafting, but then it wouldn't have the same value as a patent would have in that jurisdiction. The second thing is that, you know, in each jurisdiction, because you're exploiting the patent and it's a territorial right, it's always a good idea to check for the strength of the patent. During the process, if it's not a registered patent and it's still in the prosecution stage, at what stage is it in the prosecution history, likelihood of grant of that patent, etc. So softwares per se are not patentable in India, unlike some other jurisdictions. So that's an important differentiator to be kept in mind. Coming to the question of who can file a patent, if the patent has to be filed by somebody who is resident in India, then the patent application necessarily needs to be filed in India first. If that's not the case, then unless you basically get certain foreign filing permissions from the Indian Patent Office, if that doesn't happen, there are consequences to it, and they are grave consequences. For example, the application can be considered abandoned. Even if the patent has been granted, abandoned. There are also criminal penalties which are attached to such non-compliance. This is a very important aspect from a diligence perspective. And the last point that I would like to talk about on patents is a requirement under Indian law that every patentee or a licensee have to every year file a statement with the patent office declaring the working of the patent in India. Now, there are three options. You can basically say that I have worked the patent, you can say I have partly worked the patent, or I have not worked the patent. In each of these three instances, a reason has to be provided. But if there is non-compliance with this particular requirement, again, there are fines and penalties attached to it. Also, in some cases where you're not working your patent, you might also be exposing your patent to compulsory licensing. The very last topic that I want to touch upon before I hand over to Gauri again is on trade secrets. Unlike some other jurisdictions, in India, we do not have a specific law relating to or governing trade secrets. This basically means that contracts really govern the protection of trade secrets. From a diligence perspective, what really is the secret? Who has access to the secret? How is it being protected? How is it being safeguarded? Are the clauses robust enough to ensure the secrecy of the trade secret? These are some important factors one would, take into account, because diligence forms the backbone of your documentation and your negotiations as well. Over to you, Gauri. And Vaibhav, if you have any questions, please feel free to add.
Yeah, thanks, Arushi. I just thought I'll add one of the experience which we had, and that may help you. Arushi did mention about checking the title of the IP which you are purchasing, and also on different aspects on the title side. What I would also recommend is to go and check even within a group company whether the IP you are buying and the payment you are making is to the company where you are buying the IP. And I will just give an illustration to put my point properly. There was a case which we were handling. Our client bought a company which for IP. IP was the main purpose of buying a company. That company also had a subsidiary. And so when we bought the company, actually when we bought the business, we also ended up buying the subsidiary. The question really was, where did the IP reside? And we didn't know. We were told IP resides in the parent company. We were told IP resides in subsidiary company, which was fine. And but we were told that can you pay the subsidiary company and not the parent company? And we said that's fine, we'll pay the subsidiary company. What happened was we found out that the IP actually resided in the parent company, and when there are certain creditors in the parent company who raised an objection later on and actually filed a case to negate the transaction because the subsidiary company was not in India and the money which it received were actually laundered or otherwise, siphoned off to some for some other purposes and not been used to give to the creditor, and creditors could not really lay hand on that money. So what we recommend is that you need to check, even though you are purchasing an IP and you know that IP is within the group from which you are buying, you need to check which group company is actually owning the IP and whether that group company which is owning the IP and you are making payment to the right entity. I just think that's something which is an important aspect we need to keep in mind. With that, Gauri, over to you.
Sure, thanks. What I'm going to do is quickly deal with the assignment of IP as a simplicity. Transaction, and then deal with various structures so that we are able to appreciate in each structure how the issues will pan out. So some of the issues, the way I will distribute it is basically on the documentation side, what all care we need to take, and also that some of the tax and exchange control issues. So as we can all imagine that, of course, all the IP transaction documents have to be in writing and signed. The important aspect that we are recently noticing is on whether or not we can, the question that comes to say that whether or not we can sign the documents to the DocuSign or similar technology. So here under the Indian Information Technology Act, there are only certain types of signatures which are recognized as valid signatures for the purpose of any contract which is required to be signed by the party. And unfortunately, the DocuSign or similar methods are not yet recognized. So what we typically try to do is, you need to basically sign the physical copies in parallel with your wet signatures and exchange those copies, as a side, sort of activity, whilst we complete the intention of execution through the DocuSign process. The other aspect which Arushi mentioned, when we are doing, for example, a trademark transaction, what we try to do typically is also take the user-related details. For example, if a particular trademark has been used, say, for last 20 years, and I'm buying that trademark, we typically try to take the old invoices or the affidavit of use by the current owner, because in any future, any litigation, when I have to demonstrate my, right to use the trademark or my, user in a passing off or an infringement case, it gets very difficult thereafter to go back to the seller and get all that data. So as a process, we try to take that as well. Insofar as trade secrets are concerned, since we don't have a registration process or we don't have a solid trade secret law, what we then try to do is basically have the trade secret material delivered in a sealed envelope where the buyer, some identified individuals, basically verify all the material, and sometimes we even create kind of a double copy as an escrow where something is kept with an escrow agent or a lawyer as a proof that this was a trade secret that was delivered. The other issue that comes up is the recording of the transaction with the trademark or a patent or a design or a copyright registry, right? Now, as you can imagine, again here you will have a multiple things which are happening probably in the same document, where you could have an asset transfer, you can have an ongoing concern being transferred. So there is a possibility that your transaction document is much more loaded with multiple things than a simpliciter assignment of a trademark or a patent. But when we go to the registry, parties are very hesitant to file that entire document as evidence of transfer of ownership because of the confidentiality issues. So typically then what we try to do is a combination of the big paperwork that we will have as a transaction document, but a shorter, crisper document which is merely used for the recording of rights with the trademark registry. There are certain procedural issues that come up insofar as stamp duty is concerned, which I will deal in a bit. The other considerations from a trademark transfer perspective, which is very important in the Indian context, is whether the trademark is being transferred with or without the goodwill of the business. Why do I say this? Because if it is not being transferred with the goodwill of the business, we have a complete process that needs to be followed, and the assignment doesn't get kicked in unless you complete that process. The process being, you need to advertise your transaction in a newspaper, and there is a certain time period within which, if there is no objection received by the trademark registry, only then they will go ahead and register it. We have seen that sometimes international transactions, especially when they come for recording in India, sometimes this specific aspect of or the wording that the assignment is with the goodwill of the business sometimes is missed out, which then creates an issue for us to convince the trademark registry that the intention of the parties is indeed to assign with the goodwill. But there have been situations where the parties intentionally did not want to transfer with the goodwill of the business, in which case we have to undergo that entire process. The other thing which was, I think, Vaibhav and Arushi discussed at length was the scattered IP ownership within the group. At that stage also, what we typically try to do is consolidate the IP at one place before we take an assignment, because otherwise when you have multiple stakeholders and you try to do multiple documents, all your reps and warranties and indemnities and the limitation of liabilities, they become very confusing to negotiate. So typically, though it could become more cumbersome process for the seller, but ideally you should have a complete consolidation of the IP in one unit before which you take an assignment. Coming to the associated trademark, I think Arushi has already discussed, so I'll not spend time there. Coming to the exchange control regulations, in India, what happens is any cross-border transaction, we have a law called Foreign Exchange Management Act, which basically looks at the inward and outward remittances, including the asset transfer. So basically, when you have an Indian seller and a foreign buyer, where the money is coming in and the asset is going out, at that stage, we need to examine whether we need the Reserve Bank of India approval for such a transfer which is being sent outside India. Typically, the view that is taken is, if the asset is not capitalized in the books of an Indian entity, then that should not require an approval. But again, the bankers who basically come into the play for doing this particular deal, they will have their own view, and from case-to-case basis, we have to deal with that. The other issue that arises is basically where there is a foreign seller and a Indian buyer, in which case the money has to go outside India, right? And in that situation also, we have to be very clear that when the money is going out, what are the tranches in which it is going out, whether the bankers are comfortable that, there is the documentation. So this we call more like a tick mark with the bankers. Before we execute the document, we take their blessings, to basically get comfortable that they will be in a position to process this transaction in a smooth manner. There are certain issues that arises when you have a tranched payment, especially when the money has to come in, right? You do have this indemnity bucket, etc., basis which the money could be coming in tranched manner over a period of few years, in which case the money may be kept in escrow, whether in India or outside India. That itself also has its own compliance issues. I will not deal with those because that itself may take another 10 minutes. But just as a point of consideration, that escrows are not always simple when it comes to cross-border transactions. Coming to the tax considerations, now in India, any document which is a transactional document having value typically attracts a stamp duty. This is a type of tax, you may call it. But the difficulty here is in each state, the stamp duty is different. And probably those who are in the US can understand that how state laws can, create some havoc when it comes to, the execution of the transaction. So typically the IP is taxed more like a movable from 3 to 6%. But another important issue to be kept in mind is a trademark may attract in some states a different percentage versus a patent or a copyright. In some states, copyright may be exempt, for example. In this situation, and these, because the value of the transaction could be fairly large, then what we try to do is split the documents to say that this is a trade, and this is the document under which the trademark is going, this is the document under which a patent is going, and then separately stamp it. While you may have a single document for an asset transfer, more like an agreement to sell, and then you actually have transfers being undertaken under different documents on which you pay the stamp duty. Coming to the quick tax points, of course, if any transaction, this is again in the cross-border context, if any transaction is appearing in the nature more of a royalty, and it's an Indian buyer, and there is a payment from India to outside India, then depending upon the nature of the actual rights that are getting transferred, the royalty could be about 10%. Coming to the goods and services tax, now this is a completely new animal for last 2 years for us. We are still navigating this. So this particular goods and services tax law basically replaced all the indirect tax laws in India and has created its own system overall, and under which you could have for IP transfer, depending on the nature of IP, 12 to 18%. However, interestingly, the export transactions are exempt. So whenever we are negotiating any export, when I say export, it is the Indian seller and a foreign buyer. Typically, you could get a refund of that GST. So your documentation can be negotiated accordingly. It could be a cash flow issue for the Indian seller, but over a period of time, they will be able to get a refund. So this, now taking these items into account, what I'm going to do is the case study. Now, coming to the joint venture, and this is a very, very common phenomenon, where we have seen that the joint venture partners basically come together and decide that I have brand X and you have brand Y. However, the joint venture will use the brand XY because we want the joint venture to benefit from our combined goodwill in the minds of general public. And therefore, we will sort of, let the joint venture use it as a combined one. So the question will be that, first of all, obviously, each party will have to, probably license that trademark to the joint venture. Whether it is registered trademark or unregistered doesn't really matter, because in Indian law, of course, we recognize the common law rights. So basically, that will be licensed to the Indian entity. The next issue that arises is who owns that trademark, XY. Interestingly, under Indian law, when you talk about joint ownership, one concept would be, yes, joint venture partner one, joint venture partner two, jointly own the trademark and register that as a joint trademark. However, Indian law doesn't allow such two individual parties who are working independently of each other to have a joint ownership. So their application would get rejected. If it is owned by by the joint venture entity, when X trademark is actually a licensed trademark and Y trademark is also a licensed trademark, can we say that as a licensee, I own X and Y trademark? Right? There are no clear answers to that, but these are the issues that arise. And depending upon the facts and circumstances of the case, we decide whether we should go and register that trademark, whether the trademark registry will raise an objection basis the earlier trademark of X and Y. All of these are very, very fact-specific issues. Or they say that we will simply not say who owns the trademark. It's simply joint venture entities owning in, as a licensee. then the question arises that if there is a third-party infringement, somebody creates a trademark XYY, who goes and sues for infringement? Because if a joint venture entity is owning XY, fair enough, it can go and sue. But if it is not recognized as the owner, then whether joint venture partner 1 and 2 will go and sue together or not, this is the other issue that, you know, one has to keep in mind. Of course, after dissolution, if at all it's a joint venture entity owns the trademark, after dissolution what happens? Right? So these are issues. There are no clear answers on the trademark law on this. However, as I said, on a case-to-case basis, we deal with that, of course, keeping in mind the commercial intention and the strategic intention of the party. The other structure that we have commonly seen is a global assignment, where sellers and buyers, the main seller and buyer is completely offshore. So basically, the seller is selling the IP to the the offshore buyer. Each of them have their own wholly owned subsidiaries in India. In which case, if you can see on the left hand side, you have a wholly owned subsidiary in India, which has actually used that IP in India, right, over a period of time. So because of certain tax reasons like transfer pricing, etc., there could be certain value allocation. So suppose seller is making, say, $100, there could be an attribution of that $100 in the hands of an Indian entity. In which case, documentation becomes very, very tricky, because from an IP perspective, typically, WOS India has absolutely no rights. It's simply a licensee. That's the IP law, but from a tax law perspective, you need to give some value, right? So we have seen some of these situations, and you know, we have to creatively, basically the concept of an economic owner that is recognized under, you know, the tax law, we have to somehow build it in the document so that we can justify as to why the Indian entity is receiving that consideration. Then what happens is you have an wholly owned Indian entity of the seller. Actually, because they have used a brand in India, they obviously have other assets attached to that. For example, inventory, probably software licenses, if it's a software, you know, business, or otherwise as well. Then employees, vendors and customers contracts attached to the business. So in which case, though the IP is being transferred outside India, all these assets get transferred in India. In which case, you always have the confusion whether it's an asset transfer or a sale of the business as a going concern, which is a slump sale. The reason this becomes important is from a tax perspective. So, for example, slump sale typically is viewed as tax exempt from a GST, which is a goods and services tax, whereas asset transfer is not. And in case of employee transfer also, we need to be cognizant whether it's an employment termination and rehire, or is it a transfer of employment. In case of transfer of employment, certain specific labor laws get kicked in. Though it doesn't appear to be an IT issue per se, but this is a very, very common issue that arises because of the global transfer of IT that has happened and the effect of that in India. And because of that, we need to be cognizant of all the how the IP business basically gets assigned within India. In this case also, who's giving representations and warranties, for example, for the physical inventory? And we had these situations that, you know, technically it's the Indian subsidiary who should be giving the rep and warranty. Then the question is, the actual reps and warranties are completely negotiated at the global level. How do you include those reps and warranties then in the local documentation, and whether there will be multiplicity of proceedings at two different levels? So this is very, very interesting issue we had recently handled, and we had to, you know, sort of resolve in a very particular way, again, depending on the commercial consideration. Same thing goes for other vendor contracts, customer contracts, etc. Coming to the other, quickly on the structure that I will talk about here, where we had dealt with this particular transaction, where the IP was getting transferred outside India from an Indian seller, but the Indian affiliate was taking the business over. In this case also, as in the earlier case, the situation was all the assets were getting transferred from the Indian seller to the Indian so the Indian affiliate of the offshore buyer. And in this case also, there was a deferred consideration in which, you know, we had the escrow situation. So in this kind of a deal, again, there was a question that whether the indemnities that are being given should be available to both the affiliates, or they should be available only at the offshore India level or not. And if so, what remedy does an Indian party have if at all they face any issues because of the use of that IP in India as a licensee of the offshore buyer? So the intercompany agreement will have to be done appropriately so that each party has a remedy against the seller. And that will also basically, you know, dive into your rights and warranties as a seller vis-a-vis both the entities. So I will hand it over from here, considering all these facets as to in these different situations what Vaibhav's experience has been when the documents are negotiated on rights, warranties and indemnities.
Thank you, Gauri. During reps and warranties and indemnity negotiation, I think the first point is what reps will the seller give to the buyer. Invariably, the most critical and most important is the title or the sole and exclusive right to own or use the IP for which the rep is given. From buyer's perspective, that's a very critical ask, especially if IP is important for purpose of the acquisition of a company or you are just acquiring IP itself. So that's something which, if it is important, it should go as a fundamental rep. And I'll come to the fundamental rep a little later. Similarly, if you are asking for sole and exclusive right, which is the title for the IP, you also will add up the consent and the waiver as a part of a fundamental right, which means that you will say that, look, you don't require any consent of anyone else whoever has a right has waived that particular right in order for you to transfer that. So that's the point number one. The other rights which you will look into it would be with respect to that there are no dues which is payable on the IP, because IP can be either self-generated or they may be licensed in. If it's licensed in, then you want to make sure there are no royalties which are outstanding. Similarly, if IP is self-generated, then you want to make sure that there is a valid registration. Even in a situation where IP is licensed and they are licensed users, or IP is capitalized by getting acquired, then you want to make sure there is a proper registration done. And thirdly, we need to ensure that there is no lien or encumbrance. That's the other set of reps and warranties from buyer perspective you will ask. And generally, when we see buyer and seller perspective, this particular points are less negotiated and generally agreed upon. Then there is another set of reps which is asked. Typically, from perspective of IP, because the value of IP is only if it's not diluted, so you want to, from purchaser perspective, you want to ensure that there are no infringement of the IP which is buying, because if there are infringement and if the seller is not taking any action, that can lead to deletion of IP and IP value. So you will seek a rep saying that there is no infringement or there is no dilution, or if there is infringement, the seller has taken all actions to protect his IP. So that becomes an important aspect. Similarly, on the other side, you also want to take a rep saying that their IP or their product which you're buying does not violate third person IP. The third party IP infringement is also an important factor. Now, here we see some negotiation. The negotiation typically would be with respect to, I will give this particular reps, but I will give it to best to my knowledge, or to my knowledge, or sometimes you negotiate to my knowledge after doing due diligence. So there's a lot of negotiations at this level to see whether this particular rep needs to be caveated or not. Now here, again, the caveat, the argument from seller perspective always will be, look, I cannot know everything in the world, which means there is no way for me to tell you that nobody is infringing my IP, or nobody, I can tell you that nobody, nobody's IP I'm infringing. So I can only give it to best of my knowledge. So that's the typical argument which comes up. But then the fundamental aspect is always who takes the liability in case there is an infringement of third-party IP, or if the IP was not properly protected by not going after somebody who was infringing the seller's IP, and as a result it has diluted the value of the IP, in which case who bears the cost, who bears the liability? We often tell the purchasers that, look, in a situation where this kind of negotiation happens, we can say that while we agree to a situation where we can caveat this particular infringement clause with best of the knowledge, but in any case, if there is any dilution or if there is any infringement, we want to get specific indemnity for that particular purpose. So that's the way to handle it at that point in time. The another area from rep perspective is a disclosure. When you are buying a company, and somebody as a part of your disclosure statement, it will say, hey, I own ABC IP. Now whether that's sufficient or it is not, so you want to have a sufficiency of IP to run the business kind of a rep, which says that all IP which you have disclosed are the only IP which company owns, and they are sufficient to run the business. Now, this is an important aspect, because what we have seen many times, that company itself does not know what IP they have. And when the disclosure schedule comes, they will simply list one or two or three IPs which comes on top of their mind. They will not list all IP. And if they don't list all IP, then you don't get those IPs. And if you don't have the rights to those IPs, but if that there are certain other IPs which are required by the company to use it, then either company is using it without having the title or without owning it, or there is a dispute later on by someone saying that, hey, you did not have this right to use the IP, and then you are using it. So we always want to have this kind of sufficiency of IP rep on this. Now, similarly, a lot of IP, especially IPs which are trade secrets, while you purchase, it always remains in the minds and of the seller, especially their employees. So you want to ensure that you have some kind of non-compete or non-use of IP. In some situation, you can have a non-compete, and that non-compete can include non-use of IP. In other situation where you can't have a non-compete, or non-compete is not enforceable as it is in many situations in India, then you want to ensure that you have a clause which says that, look, the seller and the key management will not use this IP or challenge the IP that this IP belongs to us, and will not use IP for a particular period, or similar IP for a particular period. So this is something which is important. Similarly, having a clause which asks for reasonable assistance in future to perfect the IP, or in case there is anything needed to help on the IP, is also an important clause which we should have in this particular agreement, the IP purchase agreement. Coming to indemnity, what we see is indemnity is typically divided into three buckets. One is fundamental indemnity, where generally the limit, the cap on the liability is 100% of the purchase price, and the term for which the reps are valid is either 10 years or unlimited. Then it comes to tax warranties, which has a separate liability cap and a separate term cap. And then all the other assets. The typical liability cap negotiate for other assets range from 15% to 35% of the purchase price, and the term typically is kept between 2 to 3 years. Now, IP is very important to know where it falls into. We have seen during our negotiations that if IP was a critical aspect, it forms a part of fundamental asset, fundamental reps, and if it was not, it may fall as a part of other reps. Generally, where IP is critical, it should fall part of fundamental rep, and we should have a full recourse of 100% to the purchase price. But there have been negotiations, and we have seen anywhere the liability cap being negotiated between 50% to 100%. So this is something which is kind of a market on a IP where it is a critical component for purchase, or where the value for purchase of that particular company is high. So this is something which is an important perspective. Again, from time perspective, 3 years while have been sufficient. If it is fundamental, if it is a fundamental rep, then we generally negotiate minimum of 10 years. That leads, I will just touch upon a couple of other points on governing law on jurisdiction and on competition. Now, again, I don't think we have enough time left, so maybe I'll just mention that any of this particular transaction, you need to keep competition law in mind, both on an acquisition, whether acquiring a particular IP as an asset or acquiring a company is subject to competition commission's approval if it meets certain threshold. 99% of our transaction do not require approvals because we have what we call SME exemption, where if the assets you are purchasing, or the business you are purchasing, or the company you are purchasing, if its revenue is less than 1,000 crores, which is 10 billion rupees, or if assets is less than 350 crores, which is 3.5 billion rupees. In which case you get the SME exemption and you don't need to go for approval. But if you need to go for approval, you also need to ensure a gun jumping situation. So that's something you need to keep in mind. I think governing law, generally we have seen India, though you can keep New York or California, most of the time is negotiated in India. If you negotiate governing law in India, you can still have, if it's a cross-border transaction, you can still have arbitration in Singapore or in New York or in California using local rules. That's perfectly fine. If you do that, you want to ensure that you have an ability, you carve out a situation where if you need to get an injunction, you should be able to get injunction in Indian courts. This scenario which I'm telling you is in a situation where purchaser is offshore and the seller is in India. So with this, I conclude the discussion and leave platform open for question and answers.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may please press star then 1 on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star then 2. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. To ask a question, please press star then 1.
Yeah. Lynette, in meantime, is there any question on WebEx? Please tell us.
As of right now, no questions through WebEx.
Okay.
Participants who would like to ask questions, please press star, then 1. Participants who would like to ask questions, please press star, then 1. The first question is from the line of Aman Sinha from Bosch. Please go ahead.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Yeah. So my question is, it is specifically to the aspect of designs. So what are the due diligences that should be done when, say, one entity is looking forward to going for design infringement? And what specifically is meant by Section 22 of the Design Act when it limits the amount that can be claimed for contract debt?
Right, so let me just first deal with your first question on the due diligence aspect, right? Because typically when we talk about design, as you are aware, in India, only the original design gets the registration, right? So what we have typically seen is often people don't realize there are two elements. People often go ahead and register a functional feature of a design, which technically actually should not have been registered, but they go ahead and register as as a design registration, because typically it's only the what is pleasing to the eye, to put it simply, is the feature that gets the design registration. So what we typically do is, first of all, ensure that the design that has been registered in fact qualifies as a design and it's not a functional feature that is being registered. Number two, often parties go ahead and register without realizing a design which is already a existing out there in the market. Now, unlike the trademark and patents, design search could be very, very cumbersome, because you don't really have a search result that you can carry out. But now we understand there would be some tools, and we in fact had a matter where there was a, where we had to conduct due diligence for a chair registration of a design of a chair, and we wanted to check whether or not there are prior designs. So one would typically try to carry out search of whether there was an existing design out there in the market before the date of application of a design registration, because if there was a similar product out there in the market, the registration which has been granted itself will not hold much value, because when you go ahead and try to enforce that, obviously the so-called infringer will do all the searches and try to show that the design has not been appropriately registered, and in fact can also call for cancellation of a design, in which case the entire value in the design goes. Also, you will not be in a position to get even an injunction, even though the design has been registered. So typically, these are the two issues we have seen in the due diligence process. What was your second question? Sorry, and I may not be in a position to answer that fully. But if you can explain what the question you were looking at?
Yes. What exactly is meant by contract debt? Because the Design Act is limiting the amount for that to 25,000 rupees.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly does contract debt refer to?
I think I'll have to look it up and separately mail you about it.
Okay.
Because we'll need to also look at the current case laws, because as you said, slightly vague, and I'll rather refer to the existing latest case laws before I answer that question.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Participants who would like to ask questions, please press star, then 1.
Yeah, I think we have time only for one question, so if there's any other question, happy to take.
Sure. So nobody in the queue as of now.
Okay. So then I think we have reached the time limit also. So maybe we can close.
Sure.
Yeah, what we could probably also do is we have a very detailed paper on the issues that we have discussed on the IP transaction. So we probably will separately mail it across to the participants. So those who already have it, of course, will get it again. But those who specifically want it, we'll be happy to mail them a copy of that.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, as there are no further questions from the participants, I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vaibhav Parekh for closing comments.
Yeah, thank you. I think Gauri already mentioned it about the paper. We'll send you the paper. And if you have any questions which you want to ask separately, you can just email us and we'll be happy to answer any questions. And thank you for joining. I know it's late in India, so thank you. I know it's past lunchtime in New York and close to lunchtime in California. So thank you, everybody. Really appreciate you joining. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.